and welcome to the first edition of a new show. It's called Big Mouth, and every week we'll be bringing you, we hope, some clever conversation about the music and entertainment that makes the world go round. On Big Mouth, some of the best journalists and broadcasters in Britain will join me, Andrew Harrison, to pick over the bones of pop culture and work out what's really going on. From music, movies and TV to internet storms, brilliant ideas and catastrophically bad ones, we will enthuse, squabble and generally read the tea leaves of what's really happening in the world of the stuff we love and that we hope you love too. Joining me this week are Andrew Collins, a writer, TV critic, radio presenter, inventor of the little-known Lion Pop and Fraggle Rock scenes when he was at the NME, if I recall correctly.
One of those.
And more recently, film critic at the Radio Times. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Hello. You also co-created one of the many fathers of Britpop with Stuart McConey and me at Select Magazine.
Yeah. That was a good lunch.
It was a good lunch, wasn't it? Did you participate in the indie amnesty on Twitter recently where everybody had to confess to their indie crimes?
I realised that I could have spent all day doing it, posting pictures of myself. One, yes, where I'm dressed as Fruit Bat, actually pretending to be Fruit Bat in, yes, New York with Jim Bob from Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine. That was probably the peak of my indie amnesty.
You need an entire indie sort of reconciliation commission to, yeah, yourself, don't you really?
It was a warm day. I liked it because there was a lot of love in it. It wasn't hate-filled.
It wasn't.
Unlike,
right,
most of Twitter.
Yes.
Did you go on the famous Euro journey with the Fruit Bob and Jim?
I didn't.
Jim Bob.
I didn't. And the reason I didn't is because I was ill that day and I couldn't go. So Steve Double, the photographer, wrote the piece that I was supposed to write and took the photographs.
Then the rest of us were ill the next day.
Yeah, I felt great the next day.
Also with us is wonderful Jude Rogers of The Guardian and The New Statesman. She lectures at London's Metropolitan University and she's written a book called Pop, which is aimed at small children to persuade them to take an interest in pop music. It's a,
yes,
history of pop music for the little ones. Hey, Jude.
Hi.
What's the most important thing you discovered while selling the idea to pop music to little kids?
The most important idea, that's a good question. That kids are always, well, basically kids will find anything from a pop song. If there's a song that kind of excites them, it might be the beat or the sound of a voice or whatever, they will kind of go off and start making up these little worlds about these pop songs, which is great because that's what I used to do when I was, you know, little.
I can definitely remember doing that as well. I couldn't, yeah, tell the difference between Top of the Pops and Doctor Who. I thought it was all part of the same thing because the costumes were the same.
I did a piece which I kind of got all these kids to listen to the new hot sounds of 2016 and they had to talk about them and it was hilarious. They not fans of Jack Garrett, the new popular with young people.
Very discerning kids you were talking to there.
They said he sounded like a carrot and they basically started talking about carrots and carrots playing the drums and various things, which was much more interesting, I think, than Jack Garrett.
Was this in The Observer?
It was. It was lots of fun.
Go Googling, viewers,
yes,
and have a read of that. Also with us, and you've already heard his voice, moving the faders up and down, is, as he will be every week, is Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Hello, Andrew. I'm fine. Thank you.
Excellent. Keep us sounding nice. Now, you may have noticed, coinciding with the annual Real Music Festival, that is Record Store Day, the BBC had a survey that said, although sales of vinyl are up nearly 60% year on year, almost half of the people who are buying vinyl records don't actually listen to them. They're treating their vinyl purchases as an objet d'art or a consumer statement. Is this a good thing? Are people who buy records without playing them monsters who should be shunned from polite society? Is the plural of vinyl really vinyls? Before we get into all that, here's a little something from the best-selling vinyl of 2016 so far, and you'll never guess who it's by.
In the villa of Amen, in the villa of Amen, stands a solitary candle.
David Bowie's Black Star, available on black vinyl, obviously. Three of the 10 top-selling vinyl LPs this year were by Bowie, and you can probably guess why. Vinyl is also now a fashion item. It's on sale in both Urban Outfitters and Tesco. Now, people get very wound up about this, don't they? About the taking of vinyl records away from real music heads, and that it's embraced by fashion people. Do you guys buy records and not play them and just keep them because they're nice?
Yes.
You do?
Yes. I always want to play them. But when I was a teenager, that's how I bought music a lot of the time. I'd go to secondhand shops and buy something for £1 that had a nice cover. That's actually, you know, because good music generally comes as, you know, it's not just music, it's the art, it's the object, it's the liner notes, it's the world it creates. I bought Closer by Joy Division just because I thought the cover looked interesting in a secondhand shop in Stepney Arcade in Llanelli. And I was trying to be a goth at the time, which didn't work very well because I was too cheerful. But that's how I found out about Joy Division. And I knew who New Order were, but kind of hadn't really got who Joy Division were. This is, you know, mid-90s. I hadn't read about... It was before Joy Division was really being talked about again in the press. And, you know, I did that with lots of records. My first Kraftwerk record was because I thought... Oh, that looks, you know, it was Pocket Calculator and 7-inch. I thought, oh, I like that. It's in sort of computer language. What's going on there?
When you bought the Joy Division record, were you shocked by what it sounded like? Was it what you expected from it?
It was much gothier than I thought it would sound.
Gothier than that.
It still sounded quite gothy. It sounded. But yeah, I basically spent the next month in the front room in my mum and dad's house with the lights off, listening to it when they were out. You know, I loved it and I got really obsessed with it.
And as the mother of a wee boy, is your turntable in working order or is it covered in towels and nappies at the moment?
No, it's in working order. To be honest, we probably have Spotify on a little bit more because, you know, he is quite interested in lifting things up and messing with things. So he'd probably break the stylus and daddy would not be happy. I don't mind, really. Can never get fixed. But I have played records for him. He likes watching them going round, but he wants to put his finger on them, which is obviously not ideal.
Cats also like watching them go round, which is why my turntable doesn't work, because a cat launched herself at it and that was the end of that.
You put the cat on the turntable if it's very small and just watch it.
Going round at 16 RPM.
Yeah.
Is it only me who remembers taking records out of the library? Because I got a lot of my early records in the sort of post-punk period, which is my first flowering, from the Northampton Record Library, where you just go in and they would have a small section of what probably was called New Wave. And I got loads of interesting records out of there.
So what New Wave records were in the Northampton Library?
There was Andy Partridge solo album, which I can't remember what it's called now, but I took that home. I listened to a lot of records there which I'd never heard before and which I'd immediately taped onto cassette. And then owned or didn't own. Also, when I was on holiday,
you killed music.
I did kill music, yeah. But I also, whenever I had any money, I'd spend it only on music. So you know, I didn't spend anything on drugs when I was 7 or 8. There was I went on holiday. We went on holiday, and while I was on holiday, I was so loved by records that I bought a single while I was on holiday, which I had no way of playing because there was no record player where we were staying. But I wanted it so much, and I just sort of held it and looked at it. It was just a 7-inch single, and I looked at it until I got home. Then I played it.
I can completely understand this. The BBC had a clip of a young lad who they'd sort of obviously they thought they'd caught a bit of a live one here. He was walking around a record shop saying, "I collect records. I've got 7 records. I'm a record collector." And he pulled out a copy of the Amy Winehouse soundtrack album and sort of treated it as it was a big find. Well, that's one of the most, you know, easy to get hold of releases going. And the whole world of social media starts lampooning him and laughing at him. I thought that was rather mean because, as Jude says, you know, isn't this how we always used to consume music? It was as a full art package. And I was quite touched by the idea of this lad who didn't need to do this stuff, can get it all for free anyway, treating it with a bit of reverence and being kind of enthralled and mystified by the idea that this stuff exists as flat black plastic.
Yeah, I bought 2 copies of what, at the time, in about 1983, were my absolute favourite records, which were Faith by The Cure and Pornography by The Cure.
Yeah.
And I bought a spare copy of both so that I could play one and keep one. Yes. You know, that is a lovely thing, which nobody will have to do ever again.
I still do that. I've got 4 copies of Architecture and Morality by Omd. Just because I see it, kind of in good condition, I think, I'll give that to somebody, or I'll keep that, or, you know. I've got 4.
Apparently, Ozzy Osbourne has a different box set of The World at War in every one of his houses because you need to have one of the houses. Who would do that? So what was the last bit of vinyl you actually bought with money?
Oh, a last bit of vinyl actually bought with money.
Because we get records for free in our business, don't we?
But that's interesting because I bought the Arctic Monkeys single in their kind of first flush and they put a single out on vinyl and we were going through a real sort of Arctic Monkeys, you know, phase just when everybody else was, but going to see gigs, which I'd stopped doing, you know, actually paying money to go abroad to see them and stuff like that. So really, the Arctic Monkeys, you know, which I wrote about in a defunct magazine, Word, and with great passion. But I also bought the 7-inch single of which they put out specifically on vinyl because it felt like the right thing to do. I never played it. I don't have a record player, but I wanted it.
In the spirit of sponsorship.
Yeah, and that was when I was in my 40s. Yeah.
I remembered, so I bought an EP by, there's a Welsh sort of art pop creature called Mylir Jones, who used to be in this band The Racehorses, and he's made this really great record, which is called 1983. I bought one of his EPs, but I really liked him. I'd heard him, I'd heard a track on the radio, I played him on Spotify, I went to his website, I bought, you know, went to his Bandcamp page and bought the actual vinyl because I just thought, I really like this guy. And almost it was like his first things. I wanted to have them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I did.
I buy vinyl all the time and scarcely play it. I paid a fortune for that New Order box set thing where it was like extended 12-inch versions of the Music Complete album. Really, really great. Coloured vinyl, absolutely lovely. Paid, I don't know, 75 quid for it. And then just put it out on CD for 9 quid. So I feel a bit cheers, cheers, swizz there.
I've got a suede box set at home that I haven't opened. It's my suede hating husband keeps saying, you know, should sell this. And I was like, no, but it's there. I've got it.
Did you it out with your husband before exchanging vows? Because this sounds like a deal breaker hating suede.
No, it's just one of the things you've got to come to accept. I went to see suede like 2 weeks before I was due to have the baby. And he was like, if you have the baby at the suede concert, that's not a good idea. Well, that'd be brilliant.
It would be a brilliant idea.
That'd be a B-side for
the next
record.
Driving me mad.
But do you buy vinyl in record shops? Do you go do the whole experience or do you sit there and buy it online?
I actually buy it online because I now finally understand what used to intimidate people about record shops, because since I was last properly buying records frequently, like on a sort of semi-daily basis, the world of genres has expanded so much that I actually, and this is my job, and I still feel lost in a record shop. What a pathetic thing to admit on a radio show.
Oh, I feel a lot less lost, actually. And, you know, because when I was growing up, it was quite intimidating for a young lady to go into a lot of record shops. You know, I know this has been, you know, this is not an incredibly original observation, but a lot of places now are a lot friendlier, and you know, I go to lots of record shops in London, and you know, even the ones that I used to be terrified of going into, the atmosphere has changed. You know, Rough Trade East in East London, I still go to a lot. And if I'm in a random town anywhere in Britain and there's a record shop, I will go in there now. Mm. I think people have realised they have to be, well, they want to shift the product, so they have to be nice. But kind of the reason I bought lots of vinyl in my teens was because there was this middle-aged woman who ran this second-hand record shop, which is quite unusual at the time. But I very often would go in, walk around, see things I wanted, but I thought, I can't go to the counter, I'm too scared, and walk out again.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, Record Store Day, if it's really replicating, you know, reintroducing people to the experience of record shops, surely you've got to find a really snotty, passive-aggressive person behind the
who refuses to sell
the counter.
I'm not selling that. You're not allowed to have that.
Totally.
So I used to buy records in Probe in Liverpool when Pete Burns was behind the counter, and that was an ordeal. That was, you really felt like you were going up before, you felt like you got up before the judge, and he would, on the very occasional moments where he would sort of nod and go, oh yeah, nice. You know, he'd say, be still my beating heart.
I used to buy records in Revolver when Daddy G from Massive Attack was behind the counter, and that equally was like kind of, did it meet with his approval? Would you kind of actually wait until he went off on his lunch break and then you kind of went up and bought?
I used to have the exact opposite experience at Crash Records in Leeds when I was a student with Chock, who was in a band called The Hollow Men. You may remember them. He used to work in Crash, and I would walk through the door and he would go, right, you need this, 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 this. And he'd just load me down with 12 inches. And there would go all my student drinking money for the week. And I'd totter off back through Woodhouse Moor with what I'd been prescribed by Chock.
Do you think he was on some kind of sales plan, that he was just like, see the gullible little student coming through the door, and just that's my wages made for the week?
Possibly, but considering these were all kind of like heavily discounted Age of Chance 3-inch CD singles retailing for 75p, I don't think he got rich off it. Do you know what I mean? Before we move on, quick thing: is it okay to call them vinyls?
No,
it's not. What should we call them?
Records.
LPs. Bring back LPs.
I love LPs because it's
spelled ELPEE.
Short.
Yeah, maxi play on microgroove LPs, and use MTEX to clean them or whatever it was called. EMITEX.
You should say LPs, and you should also say that you tape things off the telly.
Yes, absolutely. Anyway, moving on. That's enough about vinyl. Let's inaugurate National Low Quality Download Day with a bit of music played from hand sourced Virgin MP3.
Across the purple sky, all the birds are leaving, but how can they know it's time for them to go? Before the winter fire, I will still be dreaming.
That was Sandy Denny with The Straubs, and Who Knows Where the Time Goes, taken from the new collection I've Always Kept a Unicorn, the acoustic Sandy Denny. Although she died 38 years ago, Sandy Denny still exercises a mystical pull. She is the tragic face of British folk rock. Jude, explain to a folkophobe like me, an illiterate, a folk illiterate like me, What's all the fuss about? What makes her special in particular?
Right, Sandy Denny is funny. The way you described her then, she's sort of, you know, when you say folk music, people have a certain idea. They're kind of like, you know, winsome, floaty, you know, off with the fairies. Whereas a lot of the best folk music is really not like that. This record that's just come out is the acoustic demos of her songs. And it's really interesting for fans to see the roots of her songs and the traditional songs that she covered. But actually, Sandy Denny was quite a character within quite a kind of... you know, quite a hardcore scene, really. Kind of, yeah. you know about, you know, folk clubs in the 60s were everywhere. Yeah. There's a bit, great bit in the book that of the same name. I've never caught a unicorn, by Mick Houghton, where one of her kind of fellow kind of musicians, Linda Thompson, talks about how folk clubs were like Starbucks in the early 60s. Yes. They were just everywhere. So it's what the cool kids did. You know, it's not kind of like, it's where the kind of shy little wallflowers went. And there was a lot of drinking, there was a lot of carousing, there was a lot of, you know...
It's like being on tour with Funkadelic in that book. It's a really good read. I was genuinely surprised at what a loose life they all live.
Yeah, and she's kind of, you read about Sandy Denny in this book, and it's a bit, like, makes you think a little bit of like how Janis Joplin, maybe, that kind of character would be in America. You know, she's one of the boys. She kind of drank everybody on the table. She was quite, you know, kind of emotional, but kind of like a good laugh and all this kind of stuff. She had a really big personality. But she has this voice, and I think it's the voice that gets people. It's kind of a classic folk voice in a way that it's quite straight, but it's a really brilliant voice in terms of how it tells stories. Mm. You know, from the very start, you know, she was somebody who used to perform in, you know, in folk clubs in Soho when she was in her late teens. You know, when, you know, Paul Simon was hanging around and pilfering songs off people, which he's admitted to. Jackson C. Frank, who was her boyfriend at the time, who's become this kind of American kind of cult folk hero who herself has his own tragic story. But she hung around with all the great and the good of the folk scene. There's amazing characters there, like Bert Jansch, you know, his life story is amazing. There's, you know, all these people who they're not just interested in, you know, playing, you know, sweet little songs. You know, they're interested in the, you know, folk is about blood and guts and... Mm. You know, one of my favourite songs of Sandy Denny's is called Autopsy, you know, which could be a kind of, you know, a death metal title, couldn't it? there's a great quote in the book about the scene, which is, you know, we weren't, her and the people around her, we weren't on any mission to preserve folk music. We were all into free beer and getting laid. We were all stoned out of our gourds. So this was the scene that she was in. But she had this voice that stood out, and also she had this songwriting talent which she really hid and only came out a bit later, and the song we just heard, Who Knows Where the Time Goes, was the first song she ever wrote, which has been covered by loads of people. It was made famous, like Joni Mitchell's music was, and Leonard Cohen's music was, by Judy Collins before she was famous. But the tragedy around her is there was this talent that was never really harnessed. She was in Fairport Convention, most famously after, she was very briefly in The Straubs, who she did that version with now. Fairport Convention were fantastic, full on folk rock band, fantastic stuff. And then, but her solo career after that, even though in the early 70s singer-songwriters were, you know, everywhere, they didn't really know what to do with Sandy Denny because she'd sort of been typecast by this folk idea.
But it's kind of like they didn't really know what to do with any women at that stage.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's interesting you think about kind of people like June Tabor and Annie Briggs, who both kind of like came out of that same scene, but for whatever reason weren't able to make it even as far as Sandy Denny did because they were kind of not malleable. They didn't play with kind of electric instruments, so they didn't play with any instruments at all in Annie Briggs's case. They were kind of hard living, you know. It's kind of an interesting that strong women were a bit too strong,
and they sort of fell kind of foul of the fashion, because folk rock was obviously big in the late 60s and when she was part of a band, but when you come into the early 70s it's sort of falling out of favour and more full on rock is becoming a bigger thing. You know, she sings on the Battle of Evermore on Led Zeppelin 4. You know, she kind of duets with Robert Plant, but that was not a big thing at the time. There was not much made of it.
Now it would
and
be
lots
brackets.
Of rock fans will know that.
Featuring
Sandy Denny.
That's the only Sandy Denny tune that I own, that particular track on that particular Led Zeppelin album.
So you're right there in that this stuff was just completely out of focus for a good sort of two or three decades, and then kind of at the end of the 90s,
sort of a very English folk and very British folk and very kind of traditional folk just snapped back into focus. Why do you think that happened?
I think in some ways it's partly due to reissue culture, like reissues of CDs. Now, I first came across Sandy Denny, and there's this beautiful, I can't remember, there was a label that did these reissues of Nick Drake and Sandy Denny, you know, kind of an introduction to with a beautiful little yellow kind of label on the front. And, you know, you get them for three for two in, you know, Virgin or HMV or wherever. And I think there was this almost... exploitation is probably a grand word, but, you know, back catalogue was kind of being put out there more and more. And I think that started to intrigue people.
But it also seemed to be a wider thing because it wasn't just the music, it was the folk way of looking at things.
Oh, yeah.
I think the Green Man Festival and so forth. And
definitely. You know, that was kind of like Green Man Festival started in 2004. I think, you know, the interest in obscure records did kind of fuel it a bit because people were trying to find this the rarer stuff. And people started to cover... rarer folk artists. I remember Lush covered Vashti Bunyan, you know, kind of later on in their career, and you know, I think around the last record, and almost, you know, kind of post, you know, Britpop, you know, kind of alternative music was trying to find some, you know, some kind of new area to kind of dig around in. And I think folk kind of appealed to people. Also, I think because people almost want, there's this sort of return to the land feeling that people wanted to have. They wanted, you know, to look back at, you know, simpler time and simpler music and maybe more traditional stuff when the modern world's just racing ahead.
But I first got into it, into kind of British folk, when people like Ultramarine started kind of going back to, you know, getting people like Robert Wyatt on that United Kingdoms album, which is like a fantastic record. And that kind of was a really weird way in from people who were into kind of electro and dance music. All of a sudden started opening up and thinking, oh, this is quite an interesting...
Well,
area.
I never had a folk phase, as Half Biscuit said. I want a suntan, not Vashti Bunyan. But Andrew, did you ever have a folk phase?
Folk phase began when I was signed up to write Billy Bragg's official biography, because he, of course, has a lot of folk in the music that he makes, even though he sort of started out as this punk rocker with a guitar. He grew up actually listening to Simon and Garfunkel, which, again, I think he got out of a record library and was obsessed by Simon and Garfunkel as a kid. And
do you think Billy Bragg listened to Art Garfunkel and thought, yeah, I can do that?
Yeah, probably did. Yeah, in some ways he could. Because he did the Miners' Strike circuit and stuff like that in the '80s. Because he was doing lots of benefits, he met lots of folk musicians who were also on the left. People like Leon Russellson and Dick Gohan, who I'd never heard of, but I listened to while I was writing the book because he was talking about them. And so I actually kind of found myself for the first time in my life listening to folk music, but it would be a particular kind. It would be a kind of political folk music.
Yeah.
So I found that massively appealing. I must admit. And also he got me listening to Jackson Browne and people like that. People I never listened to. So my education came through him. Although, to be honest, I don't kind of go back to it much.
Yeah. Well, I would never have ordinarily listened to this because it's just not my thing. I'm much more on what Matt was just talking about, the electronic end of things. But to hear it so unadorned and to hear that voice without a load of accompaniment to it was actually really refreshing. When so much music you hear in passing is massively produced, it was just felt a bit of fresh air.
And she's got a beautiful voice that kind of moved from low to high, you know, perfect control, but it's not pretty. It's sort of got a starkness about it. And that goes through to her later recordings where her solo stuff, sort of her and the piano, which you can tell, you know, had a massive influence on Kate Bush. And Kate Bush has talked about that she was one of her favourite artists in the early 70s, you know. And her writing is quite, you know, it's about the sea and it's about mysticism and all this stuff, but it's not, you know, weak and weedy. It's quite kind of bloody and kind of quite frightening sometimes. There's a kind of real strength in but it is, but it's kind of it kind of carved its own way. She's got a really interesting way
of
writing.
But also, I thought the interesting thing about this was, because I only knew it from kind of her music from the last, I think, double CD compilation that came out of her stuff. And I always, whenever I listen to it, I always listen to it in an autumnal or winter kind of time of year. But this is actually a lot warmer. I think the finished stuff that she did with the various kind of iterations of various bands and various groups was actually quite a cold stuff, whereas these demos are actually really warm and her voice comes through a lot more
Yeah, yeah.
A lot more rounded and kind
of. It is interesting. And she's very young. She's 18, 19 when a lot of these recordings
and
were made.
Isn't part of her myth, the important part of it, that she died young?
Yes,
and
yes,
tragically,
of course,
in a really messy and horrible way.
Yes.
The whole thing was a nasty sort of end to what was up to that point.
Yeah.
Probably quite a positive life. So that's part of it, I think.
You're listening to Big Mouth, where we pour over the entrails of what's coming around in music, TV, film and general pop culture. With me are Jude Rogers of The Guardian, New Statesman and 100 Years Ago, the much lamented and much missed Word magazine. Hello again, Jude.
Hello.
And also Andrew Collins, film critic at the Radio Times, author and 100 Years Ago, also of the much missed and much lamented The Word magazine. Hello again, Andrew.
Hello. You remember you're wistful now.
We're all very wistful. So, unless you've been living in a filthy lean-to north of the Great Wall for the last few weeks, you won't have been able to avoid Sky's campaign alerting the world to the return of Game of Thrones. Aside from winning the Westeros Nerd of the Year medal for staying up to watch it at 3 a.m, just at the same time as the Americans do, rather than watching it in normal time because you've got a job like normal people do, this is one of the few remaining examples of TV drama that lots of people are actually going to catch in real time rather than binging on the box set. In a minute or two, we'll be talking about how this has added yet another layer of tension to the office environment. Something else to fall out with people about. But first, here's a bit of what we've been missing from The Seven Kingdoms.
He's gone.
World was on fire. No one could save me but...
We're the only ones who matter. And everything they've taken from us, we're going to take back and more.
It's strange what desire will make foolish people do.
The great victory I saw in the flames... All of it was a lie.
What a wicked game you play. Make me feel this way. What a wicked thing to do.
Every one of us is poor and powerless, yet we can overthrow an empire.
You're in the great game now. And the great game is terrifying.
Order your man to step aside, or there will be violence.
I choose violence.
Game of Thrones. So, we're going to have to be careful here. Has that thing happened to that guy, or is the other thing going to happen to the different guy? Because everybody watches that as sequence now, don't they? I'm up to date. Jude, you're not quite up to date, are you?
No. I actually stopped watching at the end of season two because I was... At the end of a busy day, I didn't really want to be like going, what's going to happen? So basically, my husband watches it.
Yes.
And I read the episode guides because I actually want to know what's going on, but I don't want the absolute terror of not knowing.
You would just say you follow it on Wikipedia.
And I watch bits on YouTube and stuff. I watched the famous Red Wedding in season three. But I knew as well the night that Dan was watching the episode and I had gone to bed and I was listening out and I was going, it's coming and he has no idea. I know what's happening. So I watched in a very weird...
Did you hear him squeal? Did you hear him squeal in terror?
He came to me and he was like, oh God. He's like this. I said, I know what would happen. Yes, I knew.
Andrew, are you up to date on Game of Thrones?
Yeah, totally up to date. And I have been. And I was very careful when I reviewed it for The Guardian in video form. So I'd use some clips.
Yeah.
And I would expect that if I was reviewing the first episode, which it would be of a season, that those who didn't want to know what happened in it at all wouldn't watch it because there's plenty of warning not to watch it. But you'd always get at least one person complaining. Mm. And one person complained that the picture we'd used to illustrate the film, without them even clicking on it and watching the review, revealed that a character hadn't died in the previous season, because how could they be in the first episode of the new season if they hadn't died? And they hadn't finished watching the other one on DVD, so they complained. And I think if you are trying to avoid spoilers, the best thing to do is to go into a basement, turn Wi-Fi off, and just watch it, then come out, but don't complain. So I've been so careful in my life because of these Guardian reviews never to give anything away to anyone in mixed company, just in case.
It's almost impossible. I mean, I was on Facebook the other day and a massive spoiler for 2000 AD popped up, right? And I know I'm pretty much the only person, and it's a big thing. Matt's gone pale. It's a really big thing. It's happened, a really big thing. When we finish recording this, I'm going down to Gosh Comics to find out what's happened, but apparently it's a big thing. Should people have to censor themselves? I mean, you're a critic, so you have to think about a large readership. But should Joe and Josephine Public have to censor themselves and not say, I can't believe what's happened there?
Well, it's do they want to piss their friends off or not? That's the point, isn't it?
I think we can probably assume that anybody who's interested in The Force Awakens has seen it, right?
Yeah. No.
You haven't seen it? Well, there's a big spoiler.
I know.
Happens.
I have managed to avoid this, but I basically, as soon as I saw Star Wars in it, basically, I was desperate to see it. I know it's out on DVD now. I'm getting the DVD for my birthday next week. I just couldn't sort of childcare stuff.
So you don't know?
About that. How have you managed to... Actually, what was quite impressive was how good people were. I saw one person making spoiling that particular big thing, and they chucked it on a pub out in Old Street in Nathan Barley.
Well,
of course,
they
wall.
Did they?
Where else would it happen?
There are good fans and there are bad fans. And I, for almost every year for the last, I think, 3 if not 4 years, hosted a premiere screening in Edinburgh at the TV festival of the new Doctor Who, because it generally comes out at that time of year. And so we've had a cinema absolutely packed to the rafters with paying punters, who are all the biggest Doctor Who fans for yards around. And usually Stephen Moffat will be there and he'll come on and we'll do a Q&A. So, you know, it's a very friendly, safe place. And he, every time he does these things, he says, please don't. You've just seen, or you're just about to see, a new episode. It's not showing for a week. It's probably a week away from transmission on old steam-powered television on BBC. He said, please don't tell other people who you know are fans this thing that you're about to see or that you've just seen. And he said, he always says to me, they generally don't. I mean, he'll do sort of 3 or 4 premieres around the world and always says the same thing. And always, he says, pretty much, they say, OK, we won't, because we understand that a spoiler is going to spoil it for someone.
I'm currently halfway through Daredevil Season 2. Thought the first one was great. But there are people ahead of me. I'm desperate to talk to people about what I've seen so far. But have they seen it? Have they not? A huge part of the appeal of television and popular entertainment is you want to share it with people, don't you? And if nobody knows who's in sequence with who, you sort of feel like you're in an episode of Doctor Who.
Can't you get one of those little badge-making kits that you'd be able to get and just kind of like on your lapel every week go, I'm up to see. I'm up to episode three.
Don't speak to me about anything after this episode. Do you know the real solution to this is to have less friends?
Watch more TV.
I'm working on that.
Have friends who are older and therefore don't care. That's quite an interesting new thing I'm discovering. Or just don't go out. Remember, Titanic is one of the most successful films ever. And everybody knows that.
Absolutely. One thing that we should mention, we were all enthusing about a fantastic piece that Clive James wrote for The New Yorker about what finally giving up his Game of Thrones virginity and watching it with the time he's got left. It's absolutely brilliant, isn't it?
Incredible.
There's a fantastic,
and very funny.
I'm very, very funny. Andrew just mentioned a great bit about what he thought of the books, the Game of Thrones books.
He says, yes, he never really wanted to watch it because he doesn't like fantasy generally. And he said he picked up a copy of George R. R. Martin's first Game of Thrones novel. And he said, I fell over the same day. And he said, it wasn't because of my illness. So he got through about half a page, which is as much as I've ever got through. Yeah. But.
Okay, that's enough dragons and swords. Let's get back to music. Well, we've all experienced that horrible moment when our favourite artist puts out what you just know is a career-ending record. Sometimes it's just too much of a departure from what we like of them. Sometimes they've pushed their thing too far and it's too similar to what we like. And sometimes it's just plain rubbish. But should we try to forgive our favourites' more difficult recordings? Surely A Dog Is for Life and not just for Christmas. Before we talk about it, let's have a listen to a few selections from some career-ending records. Come out tonight in the puddles, splash some love across the sky, just you and bursting bubbles as the sky is about to cry. Tell the story. So we had Suede from their clean and serene album A New Morning, after which they split up. Happy Mondays from the legendary Catastrophic.
Very Yes, unclean and very unserene.
Very the most unclean and unserene record ever, Yes Please. Stone Roses from The Second Coming, still a vexed question with Matt Hall, led to them being falling to bits. Clash, The Clash from the allegedly bloated Sandinista, but I still really like Sandinista. Neil Young from his electronic album Trans, I wish he'd stayed standing like that. REM from Up, which is their first album without Bill Berry, which started them on the dreadful spiral of Is This an Amazing Return to Form? And finally, Terence Trent D'Arby from the gold standard of artistic meltdown freakouts, Neither Fish Nor Flesh, colloquially known as Neither Use Nor Ornament. Now, I think, apart from the Roses and the Mondays, they all sound quite good. They don't sound bad at all now. You know, it's almost as if we are so swept along with the torrent of popular feeling at the time that we can't judge things individually. What did we think? What did anything leap out from that stuff there?
It reminded me of one that I thought of between the time when you brought the subject up and sitting here, which is ABC's Beauty Stamp.
Yeah.
Their follow-up to Lexicon of Love, which couldn't be followed up without doing a pale version of Lexicon of Love. And what they did was make a kind of rock album, which yes. I absolutely adore,
It is a fantastic record, Beauty Stamp. It's got like, and it's not all rock. It's United Kingdom and SOS and beautiful songs like that on it.
Yeah, and what we're looking at generally here, if you to generalise about the tracks that we heard, is that it's a band or an artist going in a different direction, really. Mm. In the case of the Stone Roses, maybe less so. It's just the ridiculous
going off the boil. Yeah.
I think there are three classes, actually. I think there's the band and the artist going in a different direction, which is like Terence Trent D'Arby and Neil Young.
Yes.
Because they're willfully wanting to go off in a different direction.
I hope you like my new direction.
Yes.
There's kind of bands kind of fizzling out because their time has been and gone, like Suede and the Mondays, maybe definitely. The Clash and maybe REM. And then there's bands who've bought into their own myth and basically gone off and taken way too many drugs, which is the Stone Roses and the... And the Mondays. But I think that actually, I don't think it was this album that did for the Stone Roses. I think it was the fact that they didn't play Glastonbury. Yeah. I think if they'd have played Glastonbury, if John Squire hadn't broke his arm, then it would have all been a totally different story.
Yeah, that's like one of those "What if Kennedy hadn't been shot?" Isn't
alternative
it?
Because also Pulp would have been nowhere near as successful as massive as they were.
That's a great discussion.
I was there. I went to Glastonbury to see. You know, I was reading the Stone Roses and ended up absolutely loving Pulp. But then I did see the Stone Roses at Reading the following year, and they were so terrible. I crowd-surfed out and went to the Underworld. Hooray!
But that's because Squire had left and had
yeah,
Manny,
or the,
had,
yeah, the band there was
Rennie left by that time as well.
There was no real band.
Anyway, back to the point. When the band that you love, the band that you like, makes a terrible record or a record that you just can't stick with, is it hard to break up with a band? Is it like breaking up with a girlfriend or a boyfriend? When do you know it's over?
I don't think it is over if you have proper devotion to an artist, and you will see them through. And you know, if you love an artist that keeps making records, then you have to let them have a couple that aren't necessarily the very best of their canon.
I've just said I agree, and I've realised that doesn't actually play out in practice in my life. REM, for instance, you know, when Bill Berry left, people were like, okay, this is it, this is the end. Up came out, which at the time got, you know, decentish reviews, because REM always get decentish reviews. I really love that record. It's them going a bit electronic. They really love Brian Eno, who I also love. And there's a real melancholy surrounding the whole project. And it hasn't got a drummer. Literally hasn't got drums on it. It's got, you know, very different textures. No, but it is a change of direction as a consequence. It's really beautiful. I think I did fall out of love with REM, and I still will listen to everything up to maybe the last couple of records. There was a point when I think I was writing a review of, I can't even remember which album it was now, which I was surely saying, it probably tried to use the phrase return to form in. You know, you almost don't will them to do this when you review records. And then some editor, maybe Andrew Harrison, who knows, was like, you know, you need to break out of your little world a little bit and think about everybody else. It's very hard to do that. I've always found that hard. I wrote a big piece about this, about the Pet Shop Boys.
Yes.
A few years back for the Quietest website. They're a band who now I can say I don't like this record about, but know that I still love them. They had a record out a couple of years ago.
Elysium. That was the LA record, wasn't
it? Half of it I loved and half of it I didn't. And I actually wrote that in a review, and it was almost like after I'd written the review, I was like, it's okay, I cannot like some Pet Shop Boys. But if a band is sort of tied up in your or an identity, or you started loving them at a certain point of your life, you know, childhood or definitely adolescence. You know, my first love, the Pet Shop Boys, at the age of 9, when It's a Sin can blew me away, and I didn't really know what it was about for quite a while after that, but absolutely loved it. You know, it's okay for your heroes to let you down occasionally, but you still love them.
Imagine being a fan of David Bowie, and I mean someone who, as a teenager, because I was a little bit late to David Bowie. It took me a while. Somebody, and you know, I listened to all the albums in one go when a friend of mine said, you have to take these away and listen to them and tape them, and I did. But if you loved David Bowie from, I don't know, 1972, 73, and then stayed with him quite easily through the 70s and then into the 80s, and then suddenly he makes Let's Dance, which is not necessarily a bad David Bowie album, but it's a commercial album. It's a venture. It's a statement. It's I have been ripped off a load of money. Never made any money. I'm going to make some now.
Yeah.
And but you could, so you're listening to that and the one after it, which we almost dare not mention, and the one after that, and you would have to really love David Bowie to stay with him.
Yes.
But you'd count all the other albums that he's given you and all the pleasure that he's given you, which are going to be with you to the end of your life, and you go, okay, he'll come back, and he did.
Well, I think it's almost easier to kind of break up with a band when they're becoming more and more and more successful than when they're going down the dumpster.
They don't need me anymore.
Yeah, they don't need me anymore. They're, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people sitting around going, well, you know, I loved Coldplay in the early days, but I've gone off them now. And in a way, it's that sort of slightly narcissistic thing of, well, I'm so cool, I only like things that nobody likes. But when the band is sliding away and going down the dumpster, you sort of find yourself feeling, well, if I don't buy the record, who will? You know, I sort of owe them this kind of thing.
I stopped watching The Night Manager about two-thirds through because I thought it was rubbish. But I thought, oh, he doesn't need me. Look how many, everybody's watching him. Everyone loves it. The Night Manager won't even notice.
Well, I went to see the Fantastic Four movie to pity watch it because I know that nobody else watched it.
Well, the reboot.
The reboot. And it was dreadful. But the little sad thing I heard on the way out was a little kid who'd gone in with his mum. She came out, when they were on the way out, the little kid said, that's the best film I've ever seen.
And I
thought, that's probably the only film you've ever seen. God bless you.
I remember seeing the first Bond film that I saw, having been taken to every Bond film by my dad and my brother. It was a two-yearly event. Loved those films. And the first one that I saw, which I didn't like, was Moonraker. Mm. And I remember being really conflicted, because I was quite young, really conflicted about the fact that I'd just been taken by my dad and my brother to see the Bond film and not liked it. Mm. I thought it was a bit silly. I didn't like Jaws in it.
Yeah.
And so I had to kind of say I didn't like it that much. It was the day I became a critic, and it was a horrible feeling. You know, I felt so disloyal.
Isn't there something to be said, though, for splitting up with a band?
Yes.
To be the same kind of rite of passage for a kind of young person as splitting up with your first kind of boyfriend or girlfriend, because it develops you, it gives you that scar tissue, it kind of hardens your carapace.
Yes.
It inures you to the
goodbye,
disappointments of the
we'll
world.
We'll never look at each other in the same way again. Yeah, well, maybe so. I mean, just going back to some of those specific records, here at the end of that little montage a couple of minutes ago, we heard a track from Terence Trent D'Arby's Neither Fish Nor Flesh, and we were all kind of sniggering at it because it was like the acme of artistic ridiculousness with sitars on it. I have to say, I thought it sounded pretty good, and if it came out now, and not at the end of the 1980s, when people wanted another gleaming Martin Ware-produced international hit, if it came out now, people would be saying, oh yeah, Lewis Taylor, Mahavishnu Orchestra, this is great, psychedelic soul.
But it wasn't just the record, though, was it?
It was the fact that it was balmy.
It was the name change and the pronouncements about where he stood in the pantheon of world leaders.
Yeah.
It was the whole kind of
But transpose that forward to now, and somebody's saying that they stand in the pantheon of world leaders and have created themselves the greatest artist in history.
Well,
hello, Kanye West. It would go down really, really well. People would love it, particularly if it was a lot of sitar-adorned, you know, kind of neo-psychedelic.
That's Kanye's new album.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, quick find and change on that, put it out and see what happens. In fact, somebody should burn a CD and take it round to an A&R and say, we've got Kanye's new one here. He's really changed his direction. What do you think? And you would not be able to get out for the wheelbarrow of money that they would pile on you.
Is that when for the Bad album, was that when he appeared nude on the cover of Q magazine?
It
was a little bit before I got there.
Oh yes.
And it was like, yes, you can go on the cover, but you have to take your clothes off. And he went, all right, I will. And and so he was that desperate.
So he didn't turn up and go, I'll go on the cover, but I want to take my clothes off.
I don't think so. I think there was discussions about, you know, we need to really, you know, we can't just have you on
this
the cover.
This was Danny Kelly's idea,
wasn't it?
It
will be Danny Kelly, yeah, I'm afraid it was, yeah. So good old Danny.
Mm. Yes. But,
and it sold quite badly to the predominantly heterosexual white men who bought the magazine.
Well, times have changed now. It would probably go down a storm, I would have thought, in our modern non-cis world.
Much better now.
We were just talking about the idea of being a critic versus being a fan. Jude, do you think that now that critics are not what they were, that it's kind of, are we able to spot real career enders the way we used to?
Yes, maybe. I think a lot of critics are more aware of, you know, kind of the, you know, the every critic that's on social media, which I think is a bit sad in a way. I think criticism can become a bit, you know, homogenous and a bit scared of what the world is going to say about your review, especially when you've got comment under a review or something like that. But I think people are also happy to put out slightly more kind of extreme opinions if they really think this is a career ender. It's very easy to get caught up with, as you've been talking about, you know, the context that come with a record, you know, the kind of the previous records, the weight of somebody's personality or whatever. I still think the best thing to help you look think about a record is time away from it. Yeah. There's a great quote, which I will paraphrase, by Anthony Lane, writing about film criticism, which is like the best time to review a film, I think it's the same with music, is the day after or 20 years later, something like that, you know, kind of when you're in the hubbub of everything else yeah. going on already, it can be quite difficult. But I think people are starting to break out with that a bit.
Okay, we're going to end the Big Mouth show, as we will every week, with closing time chatter. With we're going to talk about, you know, that record that's occupying your mind, that great article you read, that thing you want to pass on to everyone, just that thing that you'd bring up in the pub when they think when things go quiet. Andrew, what's obsessing you right now?
Trapped is now on DVD, and that's the Icelandic drama which filled the Saturday night slot on BBC4 mm-hmm. A month or so ago, and I absolutely loved it because we've seen so much Scandi noir and Nordic noir. I don't think we've seen a TV show from Iceland on our screens before, not even on BBC4, and it came out the same time as one of my favourite films of the year so far, which is also Icelandic, called Rams, about two farmers who haven't spoken to each other for 40 years but live next door to each other in the wilds of Iceland, which is brilliant. So my favourite film and one of my favourite TV shows of the year so far have both been Icelandic, which wow. I believe is a movement.
Wow. That's why Mom's got to Iceland.
Isn't yeah. three a movement? Isn't
no,
two a coincidence?
No, it has to be two these
movement.
Days. There's so much stuff, Matt. I think three is three's just... Three, you're three's never going to get three.
Three's a whole scene on yeah. its own. Jude, your closing time chatter.
I'm still quite obsessed with trying to work out how the Discover Weekly playlists work on Spotify.
Mm.
So every Monday, if you're on Spotify, you get a playlist of 30 songs called Discover Weekly. And I am amazed by how good it is and how kind of strong it is. And I've not been paid or sponsored by the company in question. I'm just always quite fascinated with how algorithms work, you know, yeah. online, you know, and it's completely beyond my ken. But every week there will be like three or four songs that are favourites of mine, but I might not have listened to Spotify recently. And it's like, how do they know?
Yeah.
And the kind of the simple answer that Spotify have given in a couple of articles is that it's your friend... playlists of your friends, because obviously Spotify is linked up to Facebook and possibly other social media that I don't know about, but Facebook definitely. But also kind of your taste profile, so other people, what other people do. But I think the thing that is the big thing in his favour is Spotify now has a very wide library of music, and there's lots of left field stuff in there. There's lots of random things. You know, there was a weird Korean psych folk woman on Light in the Attic Records, very cool kind of label that kind of unearths, you know, obscure weird recordings at Esoterica. It's one. There's a song I've just been playing and playing again and again. I was like, which I've never would have heard of, probably, because I don't spend all my time on bleep.com or whatever.
Have you seen a film called The Terminator?
Yes.
Well, that's all I'm going to
say. My closing time chatter, which I would impose on people when they can't get away from me, is the crime books of William Shaw, magazine writer that we've all worked with in one past.
Yeah.
And he went off to write crime novels. And I would never ordinarily read crime fiction, but his books are fantastic. A Song from Dead Lips, A House of Knives, and now Book of Scars, which is coming out. And they're all set in London in the late 1960s. And the great thing they do is they show that the kind of fiction of swinging London, where everybody is an amazing captain wearing a hippie and everybody knows John Lennon personally, it wasn't true. That actually London was a fairly kind of grubby, quiet place, and the cool stuff was all happening in tiny pockets. And all the stories about the interplay between that, between the idea of what's happening in London and the reality. I also love it because huge parts of it say in Stoke Newington, where I live, so it's hilarious to read about these dreadful crimes happening in the pub that I go to. So yes, I would counsel all listeners to have a look for William Shaw's crime books.
Scrubbed up nicely, hasn't it, London? We're sitting in a very nice, pretty modern part of London that would have once been as grubby as hell.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for listening. This has been the Big Mouth Show. We'll be here again next week. You can hear us on Soho Radio. You can subscribe to us via the medium of podcasts. Thank you very much to Jude Rogers, and thank you to Andrew Collins, and thank you for pushing the knobs, Matt Hall.